Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Jason Connery, an actor with a 30-year career that spans everything from Doctor Who and Robin Hood to Bullet to Beijing and General Hospital. He's also been working behind the camera, and his latest film as a director, Tommy's Honor, opens theatrically in Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal this Friday, May 12th. Jason picked The Room, Tommy Wiseau's 2003 cult movie about the existential crisis of a man named Johnny after the end of a torrid relationship. At least that's my best guess as to what it's about. The film's story is barely comprehensible, thanks to any number of baffling choices by writer, producer, director, and star Tommy Wiseau. Is it a comedy? Is it a serious drama? It's impossible to be sure. And the resulting mystery has kept people coming back to the film, mostly at midnight screenings, ever since it first surfaced. I should also mention that Dexter absolutely loved Jason and fell asleep on him about halfway through the episode, which is why you'll hear him snoring. I tried to remove the worst of it. This is someone else's movie.
Some time ago, I watched it, and I watched it with my son, and it was just a joy. You know, I mean, we laughed, and it was one of those. It was one of those wonderful moments where you find something that I'd never heard of it. And okay. Someone said to me, "Have you ever seen The Room?" And I said, "No, I haven't." And they said, "Oh, you have to see it." And that's all I knew. And so I was taken into this world without knowing anything. And I just had such a fun time with it. And then recently, when I heard about your show, in fact, just after I heard about your show, I just watched it again. And I bought my son, and he was there when we watched it, and with my girlfriend, and I bought my son the book written by Sestero
Disaster Diaries.
And I haven't read that yet, but he would come and tell me a few stories about it and things. And and then because of your show, I started to think of it in a different way, which is also intriguing for me.
Well, that's... Yeah, what way do you think of The Room initially? That's the question, because I've been fascinated by it and repelled by it in equal measure.
Exactly.
How did you first experience
it? Well, my first experience was just that I found it absolutely and completely hilarious. I mean, I having been an actor, and I still act, having been a filmmaker, and hopefully continue to be,
sure,
as a director, and on sets, and, I felt this... You know, there are so many elements in the film that I can I've experienced actually in many ways. And what also happened to me was it was the fact that these people were so committed, and that's what makes it so wonderful in its own way. You know, and it is easy to look at something like that and mock, and I didn't feel like I was laughing in a mocking way. I was just laughing because of the real absurdity of the film,
right?
You know, it's absurd.
Yeah, and I say this constantly when discussing the concept of criticism with people. No one sets out to make a bad movie.
No,
nobody ever decides that that's the way to sell this, like this idea that I've been working on for a year or 2 years or 5 years, I'm going to make it as poorly as possible and garble it and make it an absolute misery to watch. And we've all seen those movies, but they're not
in a few.
Well, but no one sets out to create that. It's
no, absolutely.
I wonder if the embrace of The Room by filmmakers is simply a thank Christ that wasn't me kind of situation. Where
I think that, and also I think that it's the feeling as well is one of that you can see how it can happen. You can see that, you know, for instance, I've worked on films where suddenly someone who has some power in the situation, who has had no real experience, but say, for instance, and I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, but say, for instance, a producer who's put money into a film suddenly feels as though they have a sort of artistic ability, and they start writing things, or they start changing things, or they start, and there's this sort of this knock-on effect of that, almost a domino effect, where, you know, people are frightened to say anything, and then it gets further and further, and you and you're in a world where it can be quite insular. Mm-hmm. And so you begin, perhaps, because it's almost like, you know, the woods for the trees, is that you don't see how ridiculous it's become, because somehow the concept has been completely sort of transformed. And yet, in that transformation, it seems as though it's okay in that insular world. And you make this film and you think, yeah, okay, you know, in the beginning, that performance seems really a little over the top, or some of that way that person is, you know, the dialogue is really out there. But then in the insular world, where it's sort of, no, but you don't understand.
Right.
He really cares about this woman. And therefore, you know, when he's screaming like that, it's all to do with the pain. Oh, okay, well, you know, and then in the light of day, you know, months later, or even in the edit room or wherever it is, and it's revealed, and you go, oh my word, you know, what was I thinking, or what were they thinking, or what was, you know? And I don't know whether the people who made this film ever felt that way. I've actually purposely stayed away a little bit from reading the book, and from, because I feel as though it would give me more information than perhaps I'd like to talk from the place of you and I sitting here talking, having seen the movie and just knowing that much.
Yeah, it is. Well, what you were saying about the sort of the event cascade, the mistake or the miscalculation that then multiplies further down, that's something that fascinates me about The Room, because it is unquestionably the product of one man. He made the movie he wanted to make. He made the decisions that he felt were right. Tommy Wiseau made this movie out of some real compulsion or urge or drive, call it whatever you want. He had to make this. There's no question in my mind that as much as, you know, Terrence Malick made The Tree of Life, or Cassavetes made Faces, it's the, or Husbands, I guess, probably more appropriate as a point of comparison. But
or recently with Scorsese making Silence.
Silence, it's the product of something that had to happen.
Right.
It was make this movie or just never be fulfilled.
Fully fulfilled.
And it's remarkable in that it is unquestionably the work of a vision, or it is a vision, that when you expose it to light, unlike all of those other examples, it just, it's incomprehensible that to experience it as, you cannot experience it as drama. You can see the drama, but you can't, I mean, I can't imagine someone being emotionally moved by the results. It just feels like it lands sideways.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when you look at it in the light of day, as opposed to, you know, just for an entertaining value, you know, I think you're absolutely right. And look, we both know how difficult it is to make a movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a myriad of things that you have to do to make a movie, and you need, apart from anything, a lot of people to come together. And there are a lot of different bits to the puzzle.
Sure.
And even just to get the film to the place where you can physically put it on the screen and show it to people, no matter how good or bad they decide it is. But the thing that hit me when I started looking at the film from a perspective of us having a conversation was I've never seen a film that has so little... what's the word? Intention. I mean, the only intention in the entire movie is for the lady in it to leave Johnny.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only thing that is actually pushing the film forward. And it really doesn't do that. But
it's supposed to be the inciting incident.
Yes.
But there's also every other dramatic point.
Right. I mean, there's and so there's a whole load of non sequiturs outside of that, but the driving force of this movie is I don't love him anymore and I want to leave him, although she doesn't do anything other than sleep with his best friend to make that happen. And so I'm thinking, when they're sitting on set, were any of the actors saying, I'm not quite sure, you know, what my actions are here, because what's my you know, an age-old thing, you know, what's my intention, where your paycheck, but
sure,
you know. But what is your intention? I mean, you know, you say I'm going to leave him, and then you don't do anything about it, and you just keep telling people, who anyone who listen really, you know, that you're going to leave. Yeah. And so for that to be the driving nature of telling a story, you know, it's impossible to keep that alive for the entire film, although that's what they try to do. There are a number of events, of course, that happen. But as I say, those events seem to have nothing to do, other than her sleeping with his best friend, with the dynamic of attaining her ability. I mean, I'm not sure why she doesn't, of course, there'd be no film, but I'm not sure why she doesn't just go, okay, yeah. I'm going, bye.
And I think that's it. I think it is simply the solipsism of the screenplay is constructed to make Johnny suffer.
Right.
And show us his suffering. And so he must have reason to suffer. And so we must be trapped with that reason over and over and over again. Even the way the film sort of casually piles tragedies on other people. I have cancer. The test came back. I have cancer. And it's never referred to again because I don't think he really cares. I think maybe in the moment Wiseau needed a reason. Maybe someone asked him, what's my motivation? Oh, well, you have cancer. Here it is. We'll just say it.
Well, and also there's also moments in the film where you know I was wondering what is that scene about, and also why is it there, and then the realization is really that you can't cut directly from one person looking at them to that person again.
Mm-hmm.
So he would cut into a scene which had no relevance, and usually the character would say something. Someone would arrive, like usually, I'm not sure if his name's Denny or Danny because of the accent.
It does change, I think, a couple of times.
Hey, Denny. Anyway, I know there's a drinking game, and if you get Denny, basically you're drunk after the first 5 minutes because almost everyone says his name about 15 times whenever he comes in.
Yeah.
And his age is a bit of a worry too because they keep talking about him being this young boy at school or something or at university, and he looks about 35.
Yeah, we'll get to the various inconsistencies. Right.
But the fact that he comes in and then he goes, what are you doing, Denny? Oh, I just am doing something. And they go, oh, I got to go. And then he leaves. And you kind of think, what is that scene about? And then you realize, well, that scene was about actually just getting to the point where we can cut back to Tommy or to, what is the lady's name in the film? Do you remember?
Oh, my God, I can't. Lisa, of course, Lisa.
Lisa, you're tearing me apart, Lisa. Of course, what am I doing? Of course,
it's
Lisa.
It's been Linda in the back of my head for an hour, and I have no idea why.
Lisa, that's right. So those scenes, those interjections, and then, of course, the cutaways of San Francisco, which I'm not sure where they came from, but I think they were probably bought.
Yeah, it feels like stock footage.
Yeah.
Or some type of really awkward CG.
Yeah.
Pre-CG. The technical side of the room is something that fascinates me as well because it goes back to the idea that, like Tommy knows best, that Wiseau knows what his film needs. Supposedly he shot it on both 35mm and high definition video at the same time with two cameras mounted to the same platform. And as a result, each camera is slightly off.
Right.
The angle is never quite right, either from the left or from the right, but you're never quite centered the way a shot should be. And that's part of the displacement, I think, that people run in and out, but they're also entering frame from a strange space that we can't fully understand. It's disorienting narratively as well as visually. And I think that's why things sort of drift.
I'm glad that you told me that. I knew that I'd heard that he bought all the equipment that he used,
which is
part of the reason that the budget seems to be quite extraordinary.
Yeah, this is also part of the legend.
And but I never realized that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there's some very strange entrances, especially through the door where, again, Denny very often, but a number of other characters come in sort of sideways. It sort of feels very odd. And also there's some very odd angles for reverses on people talking to each other. And actually, as a director, I hate doing that thing of a mid and a close in the same. I know it saves time and everything, but you do lose that sense of connection. And I think filmically, when you've got a scene, especially in close up, you have to have that. I always like to be as tight as possible so that you really feel as though the characters are looking at them at each other, and that there's an intimacy there.
Yeah. And I think, well, the room is certainly concerned with intimacy. I just don't think it understands it.
Well, talking of intimacy, the love scenes in the film as well. I mean, some of the angles and the first scene where Lisa and Johnny go at it is. I mean, it actually looks as though he's sort of mounting her leg.
Yeah,
it's a very strange angle.
They're not flattering shot choices.
No.
For a filmmaker of what I would consider profound vanity.
Yeah.
Wiseau does not... Like, he's either willing to look horrible, or he doesn't know how to shoot it.
Right.
Or it's possible... I was wondering, the last time I saw it, I was trying to figure out if he had ever even looked through the camera in those scenes. I mean, was he shooting with a body double for
oh, that's
just
true.
The sense of lighting? How would he even know what he would look like?
Yeah. Well, but
then there's playback.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, and also I heard that he reshot stuff all the time and also recast all the time.
That would explain some other...
Yes, the man who...
Absence.
Appears, yes, and a guy who appears that I'd never seen before until the second half of the film. but I that thing of... I think he thought that actually, one, it was different from what you normally see in love scenes, and two... I think there's a shot of his buttock clenching, and I think he thought that that was aesthetically, you know, kind of, one, slightly risque, and also appealing.
Essential.
Essential.
Yeah.
But also that whole drift behind, sort of, and back and forth across the I don't even know what it was, it's sort of railing, it's the staircase, but it's
also that sort of wrought iron thing.
Wrought iron thing, yes, and that. You know, again... it was not flattering for her, for Lisa either, at all. That again, I feel as though he certainly is such an original that maybe he felt that he wanted to shoot it in what he thought would be a way that an audience would be like, wow, that's surprising. I haven't seen a shot like that for, I mean...
Yeah, he is inventing a new cinematic language, but I don't know that we understand it. There are movies that teach you how to watch them as they go. Films like Memento, or films that are structurally challenging and have to force you to understand them. The Room is, I mean, on paper, it is an absolutely basic narrative.
Yeah.
Man is sad, man stays with friends, tries to understand why he's sad, is worse and worse and worse, and then ends poorly. But... he approaches it as some kind of baroque manic state. I mean, watching the film felt like watching a fugue state happening in front of me. The scene in the florists, which comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I still believe in the back of my mind that cast doesn't know they're in a movie. That someone came in, waved a gun around and said, in 30 seconds, a man is going to come in and buy flowers and you be nice to him. And everyone is just so tense. And, you know, oh, Johnny, you're my favorite customer, said through gritted teeth.
Yes.
Like, that's an uncomfortable scene, and there's no...
The dog's good in it.
The dog is great. The dog is the only one that's totally calm in the
whole scene. Totally calm. And actually gets quite a nice shot.
Yeah.
The first film I ever directed was called Pandemic, and I was so sick of being called a first-time director because I'd done shorts and everything, and I hadn't directed a film. And so I managed to get $200,000, raised $200,000, and we shot the whole thing in 12 days in Arizona, and sold it on to Netflix. And it was extraordinary experience. I mean, one day we should talk about that, but I don't want to talk about my film so much, only to say
it's all relevant. Feel free.
Only to say that there were moments in the room where I felt like my experience on that 12-day shoot, and I know they had a lot of time and everything, but I was part of me making the film was that one of the investors was in it.
Okay.
And she's a lovely lady, and but she kind of froze. And actually what I began to realize was the more I talked to her, the worse it was. You know, I was thinking to have a calming effect on her, but actually it got me more and more tense.
Did she become more self-conscious?
Or? Yes, and the words became sort of alien to her in a way, and you know, she became very flat and monotone. And that scene where I got the feeling that one of two things, either they wanted to be in the movie because he said to her, I'm making this big movie and I'll put you in it if you let us use your flower shop.
Right.
Or they came to him and said, we'd love to be in your movie. If we put a scene in, we'll give you, you know, X amount of dollars.
Right.
One of those, because I agree with you totally. I mean, it's so surreal. It really is. It walks in and everybody's standing there as though, you know, someone
there's a sniper.
Has,
in
yeah,
the background.
There was,
yeah,
someone was saying, like, if you don't say this line when he says this to you, you know, you're going to be shot.
Yeah.
And
the dog is only natural because it doesn't know that there's
exactly,
a threat.
Exactly. And he says something as well. He says, "Oh, hi." To someone, and they don't react immediately.
Yeah,
I think
there's just this strange lag,
yeah, real lag. Yeah,
that scene. I mean, that scene embodies the film to me. It is the room in my memory. That is the scene I always think about because you, on some basic level, as an audience member, you know that this scene should play. It's so simple.
Yeah.
The goal is clear. Everyone has, there are motivations. Everyone has a motivation.
Yeah, he comes in, he wants to buy flowers for his girlfriend, yeah, and he knows everyone in there.
Pet dog. Yeah. All of it's there.
Yeah.
And it won't happen. That whatever happens isn't what the
scene is supposed
to be.
That's what makes it so glorious, though. I mean, it's the same thing with the whole, you know, suddenly this whole, I don't know quite what his I mean, the whole ball scene where they're throwing balls.
Yeah,
I
knew that's what you were going to bring up.
Yeah,
people in tuxedos throwing a ball around,
right,
for no particular reason.
Yes, in a very limited space. Mm-hmm. I really got the fact that
that's right.
there was only, you know, there was nothing on either side of these people, so they had to keep it tight. And he was saying, "I want to get this in a one-er, so I don't want to do any close-ups or anything like that." And so they're all fighting in the set, trying to make it look natural.
Yeah.
And that's what the beauty of the film, and why it's so funny, is the fact that you see these people, they're all doing their best. They really are. They're doing the best with what they have, you know, and trying desperately to make some sense of this. You know, okay, I'm not sure why we're throwing this ball, but we're going to try and make it look fun, and we're going to try. And then there's probably, it got the feeling that there was no real dialogue written for that scene. So they're all sort of kibitzing, but not really.
Yeah.
So it's again joyous, because in a way, for me as an actor, I've been there, and also as a director, I've been there, you know, where you're trying to make something work and you're thinking, wow, this is I've just got to do something to get this right, and I don't know what it is. And I have no idea what that scene was about.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, is it all just about filling time to get to feature length, making it feel like there's more going on in the movie than there is? These are questions that you can legitimately ask during the film, because there is no wrong explanation.
Well,
any answer
could fit. If you start with the idea of there being only one sort of real motive, which is, you know, that she doesn't want to be with him and that he's really upset by it. I mean, they do have that scene where they're running along, and I suppose what you're setting up there is that they are indeed best friends, which
right.
they've been told endlessly anyway. I mean, it's almost synonymous with his name that they're best friends. I think his name's Mark, and they're always talked about as, you know, Mark, your best friend.
That's right, yeah. It's
so,
not even subtext, it's active text.
No. And then I love all that stuff too, where it's almost like where Lisa is seducing Mark. She kind of says exactly what she wants from him and also what they're going to do, and then he says, "What are you doing?" You know, or he even says, "What are you doing after they've made love?"
Yes.
Which again, you're sort of like, well, I think, you know, I think possibly the character should know what's going on by now.
Yeah.
And he has these huge fluctuations, well, not huge, but he has fluctuations about how he feels about what's happened, and yet she's always, she always manages to seduce him again. And he kind of tries to make some kind of moral stance, which falls apart very quickly.
Yes.
And then as soon as it's over, he then says, "I can't do this." And you're like, "But you just did it. What do you mean you can't? It's a bit late to be unable to do it." So again, it's that element where, I mean, I don't know much about Tommy Wiseau, but
no one does.
No, he's a sort of man of mystery, and his performance in the film, you know, is again extraordinary. His delivery, and wonderful in the sense of it being completely bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he was taking some kind of relaxant because he seems almost sort of floppy all the time, sort of completely and slurry. But I you know, I found it fascinating and hilarious. And, you know, I wondered, I mean, I've got to read that book that I gave my son, because, but I did wonder, my son did say that he felt that the book is very well written, and it's one of those things where a film, anyway, to come together has to have so many elements that work. And so the idea that this film has come together in the way that it did is just as amazing as something that turns out to be something that everybody hails as being amazing. Because this film is hailed as being amazing, but amazing in a completely sort of bizarre way.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, the fact that you can... It's been out 13 years,
yeah,
and people are still going to see it. You know, and he's still touring the world with it, and he's still talking about doing a second one. And, you know, it's original. It's a real original.
Yeah. What fascinates me about, and this is something that was kind of rattling around in my head when you were talking about the need for Johnny to constantly discuss and push and come back and resist what he wants. If you are a novice at cinema or storytelling, and you're making a movie where you play a hero who isn't much of a hero, but still the star of the film, and therefore, like, it's that whole... The movie is its own tautology. Like, Johnny is the best because he's the best, and Johnny is the subject of this movie because who else would be? And I'm making a movie where I get to have a lot of sex and be sad about it and be emotional and break my own heart and then be the hero of my own story and yet also not do anything heroic. It is this incredible ego stroke if you look at it that way. Right. If you want to see a man who has made, you know, like, the quintessential vanity project, yeah, you absolutely could read it that way.
Yeah.
But what if it isn't? What if it's a legitimate attempt to grapple with feelings of betrayal and inadequacy? I mean, it is absolutely fascinating to interpret it from either direction.
Yeah.
And what is never far from my mind when thinking about this movie is that, yeah, it's been playing for 13 years. It's a global success. He will not stop touring with it. But is this his intention? Was this what he wanted? Did he always make a comedy, or did he steer into that once the reception became clear? At what point does The Room become a comedy? Because it doesn't feel like it on screen when you're shooting it. I don't think you're making a funny movie.
No, I absolutely think that he felt that he was making a really solid drama that was really going to move people.
Yeah, and
because the integrity that that all of the actors come with feels real. You know, they're saying really silly things often, and they're repeating themselves, but I never ever for a moment thought anyone was winking at the camera or trying to show, oh, I know this isn't really. And that's what makes it so beautiful. That's what makes, I mean, that whole scene with the couple that come in and for no reason, you know, a sort of comic relief.
Yeah.
Almost sort of vaudevillian, performance.
Yeah, where it's clear that the movie is trying for laughs.
It's
the only moment when you can point to that scene and say, if you shot a comedy, it would look like this.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It was, and again, it was, as we were talking earlier about, there's a character that arrives, and I don't remember his name, but he suddenly starts making quite strong accusations and sort of trying to sort things out, and I'd never seen him before. I've no idea where he came from. And then, of course, there's that scene, and I think the guy is the psychiatrist. Is that where they're all sitting, talking,
it's
and
like
suddenly
a
there's
scene.
A sort of therapy scene, which, you know, again, is this bizarre moment. And I feel as though, I only really noticed this. I noticed this more the second time that he's also trying to talk about the friendship between men and the sort of the sort of honorable element of between men, where they're trying to express their emotions but they find it difficult because they are indeed men,
right?
And
yeah, it's not about camaraderie, it's about repression.
Right. And then of course there's the bizarre scene as well with the gun on the roof, with, you know, suddenly that, yeah. I mean,
I guess structurally you need to show people that he has a gun,
right?
But that is the absolute wrong way to do it. Well, it just makes no sense.
No sense at
and
all.
None of the actors is responding. This is the other thing too, nobody is responding to the gun in that scene like it's dangerous.
No,
it's a prop. They're kind of interested in it.
Yes. And also the emotions that are flying around seem extraordinarily high pitched for what is, you know, what's happening. I mean, the guy is talking normally and then suddenly kind of decides he's not only, you know, crazed, but he's going to throw the person off the roof.
I mean, is there a chunk missing? Is something was dropped? Was something abandoned in the screenwriting process that they figured they'd fix and he just never got around to it? Any interpretation is valid because we're dealing with something where the rules don't apply, where no structure, no script, no performance is going to explain everything in that scene.
Right.
There's no one answer.
Right. I mean, I do feel like there's quite a few elements in the story where there must have been some serious editing that where things got left or scenes got left out. I mean, I mean, the whole breast cancer thing with the mother is just hilarious because she says it so kind of matter-of-factly, and then Lisa says, "Don't worry, everything's going to be okay," and you think, "Well, what?"
Yeah.
And then it's never mentioned again, and you know, then the repetitiveness also of the fact that the mother is saying, you know, but Johnny's good to you. He you know, he buys you flowers. He has a good job. You know, and you think, oh, okay, well, okay, I guess that's beginning to sound, you know, like something a mother would. And then she goes off on these tangents, and then is agreeing with her daughter, and their conversations always seem to end with Lisa telling her, "Don't worry, everything's going to be all right."
Yeah.
And then we start again with her telling someone else she doesn't love him anymore and she's going to leave.
Yeah. Almost like a series of exercises that work their way into the final cut.
Right.
Or warm-ups or something. I don't know that they're credible as improvs because I don't think the actors are improvising because their readings are so stilted that it's probably not. I mean, people tend to be more naturalistic or self-conscious in improvisational situations. And usually there's a liveliness or a rhythm to it. But again, the way the film is cut might have just taken all of that out. You can't tell.
No.
It's an unknowable thing.
Do you know at all, as far as the actors are concerned, whether any of them, you know, because I know Greg Sestero certainly did one other film.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting, isn't it? You would think these people would show up as, if nothing else, as just sort of little rogue appearances by filmmakers out to look cool.
Right.
Like the third Hangover movie would feature a couple of them somehow.
Right. Right.
But no, as far as I know, they've never surfaced elsewhere. Maybe they've just been driven away, or, I mean, maybe the residuals are enough that they don't need to work again. Although I can't imagine there'd be that much.
No, I
Wiseau would keep the lion's share.
Well, and interesting him too. I mean, that whole thing of talking about doing things. I mean,
he shot a sitcom pilot called The Neighbors that was the first episode is on YouTube, or at least a trailer for it is. But it is similarly incomprehensible. And what's weird about it is that in that one, he's trying for comedy and it reads and it's awful. It's just stiff and clumsy.
See, that. You know, when I look at comedy, the things that really make me laugh are not really jokes. Yeah, there's good jokes every now and again.
Mm.
But for me, what really makes me laugh is when I can really imagine the situation and I feel as though that situation is something that actually can happen or actually did happen.
Right.
And if you set the scene right, it becomes very funny, especially if you identify with one of the, or maybe all of the characters in it. And the thing, in a way, about that makes The Room so brilliant is that, you know, you can identify with those characters and they're taking themselves so seriously that it's hysterically funny because they're absolutely committed to what they're doing. And as soon as you, I mean, honestly, for me, if anyone had shown their hand of sort of saying, of standing outside of the story and going, oh, you know what, I kind of know this isn't great, or I think this is, it wouldn't be funny at all. It would actually be quite sad. Mm-hmm. But because of the fact that they don't and they're fully committed in it, for me, I mean, it's right up there with one of the funniest movies I've ever seen.
Have you seen it with an audience, or have you only watched
it? No, I've only watched it with, you know, two or three people, as opposed to... Have you seen it with
an audience? No, I can't do it. I thought about it. Right. I saw it on DVD the first time, both times actually, that I watched it all the way through. It comes to Toronto. There was a day when Wiseau came in himself and did the intro, and I don't think I want to experience it like that. I think it would be too uncomfortable because, well, at this point anyway, now there'll be people it's like going to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where you're primed to laugh at certain things, not because they're funny, but because that's what the room is doing.
Right.
And I don't know that I would want to be part of an audience that has so internalized the comedy already that they're just laughing on cue.
And, no, absolutely.
Idea of throwing spoons at the screen and things like that's just annoying.
Right.
My grandfather owned a movie theater when I was a kid, so now I just imagine the poor people having to clean up at the end of the day.
The other thing is, as you mentioned this before, is, you know, Tommy Wiseau sitting alone in a room. How does he feel?
Yeah.
How does he feel about it? Because it must be difficult if, as you say, we never really know whether he... I certainly don't know that he knew that he would be creating something that would have such an impact. Certainly in the impact happened.
Oh, I'm sure he had no
idea. But sitting alone in a room, you know, where you say to yourself, wow, all these people are here and they're all throwing spoons, they're all laughing hysterically, they all know every word of dialogue, and you're sitting there thinking to yourself as Tommy, you know, it's wonderful that it's being seen, and it's wonderful that it's being appreciated but I think it would be really hard if you honestly felt like you were showing the world something of yourself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as an actor, you know, I mean, he's "You're tearing me apart, Lisa." You know, he's screaming it and clenching his fists and, you know, and wailing. And then, you know, he dies because of these events. And,
yeah, he's, you know, committed. People, he's going there.
And to have people howling with laughter.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a double-edged sword, of course.
Yeah. I don't know which would be worse, having the self-awareness to suffer that every time you see the film with an audience and being, you know, essentially forced to tour with it as your livelihood long after you've finished this thing and put it to bed, or not having the self-awareness and just sitting there like Johnny Depp in Ed Wood saying, oh, this is the one they'll remember me for, this is my masterpiece.
Right.
I think that's what's so fascinating about Wiseau as a person, is that he has only done this thing and it's... and then allowed it to define him. And it's an unreadable achievement. We don't know what he's accomplished, and I'm not even sure he does.
No. And I mean, I think in a way, I kind of admire him because he's saying, okay, as an artist, I will accept and acknowledge this and actually embrace it. You know...
Yeah, it's the old story about not being able to control what the art is once it's done. Yeah.
My brother works in the art field, and he deals in the Impressionists. And, you know, I mean, the kind of values that are being put on this artwork is just extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say, well, okay, Van Gogh, you know, never sold a painting. He may have sold one to his brother, but they think he may have given it to him. But anyway, never sold... In fact, Van Gogh's brother's wife, Johanna, was the one who started to show his paintings after he died. And, you know, the father her father said, you know, you should get rid of all the paintings and sell the frames. They're worth more than the paintings. And now suddenly he's being hailed as this extraordinary, well, not suddenly, but, you know, over the course of time after he died, you know, and in a way it's a, there's a parity there because, you know, this man, you know, cut off his own ear, struggled, never sold, was determined, tried, you know, Tommy Wiseau makes this film. He lives to see it. And it is almost revered in its own way.
It is, yeah. I mean, if you say the title, people know what it is, and they have a very strong opinion on it one way or the other.
Yeah. And you know, my brother will talk to me about art and say, you should love this piece of art, because I say, I have no connection to it. I'm sorry, you can tell me that the guy, you know, is tragic and he did this and he did that. I have no connection to it. You know, he showed me the other day there was someone had made a replica of a used diaper. Now, he wasn't selling me that as something brilliant, but he was saying that's art.
Okay.
And then there's that whole conversation, you know.
I was in the Tate Modern for the first time. I'd never actually gotten into it before this past March. And even though Duchamp's urinal is a replica, it was like a religious experience.
Right. I mean,
for good or ill, that was the thing that changed the world. And it is absolutely fascinating to look at it because it is... It's not representative. It is what it is, literally. But because someone said it was art, now it is. And it sparked a movement and changed the world. I don't think The Room will have the same impact. But as an individual object, it probably rates.
Well, it certainly has its place in history. Because, you know, as you say, 13 years later, or I said, or we were both commenting on, you know, it's still there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people who, you know, work all their lives and never have anything. I mean, many people, many artists.
How many directors can associate themselves with a single thing that has this much life in it?
Exactly. I mean,
it's got to be, you know, a handful at any given moment.
I've watched, you know, some of the great comedies of all time. And I can honestly say that I laughed as much at The Room as any of those. Because it, you know, and again, we go back to, did he mean that? I don't think so, but that's what he created.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all, well, you know, my most recent film, you know, I filmed, I had a script, of course, we made the film and everything. And in the editing process, although many of the themes, hopefully, and that came through, there were many other things that happened in that editing process, you know, so one doesn't always know what one has, you know, and in his case, I'm sure it was really shocking. I mean, it'd be so interesting to be the first audience to see that film him. And, you know, what happened to him internally?
Yeah, you'd want a camera on him as the room reacts.
Right. When suddenly the audience are all falling about laughing.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they weren't. Maybe they you know, but there was a moment where that happened and he had to deal with it.
Yeah.
And he seems to have said, I'll embrace it.
Yeah, on this rock I will build my church. The only other time I can think of anything like this happening is there was a horror movie called Anaconda with John Voight and Eric Stoltz, Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
I don't know if you ever saw the ads they came up with before the first test screenings or before the first press junket, but right up until the weekend of the press junket, it was a deadly serious Heart of Darkness inquiry into man and monster and cruelty. It was a horror film.
Wow.
And the next day, there were radio spots re-engineered to be snarky and weird, playing with voices rolling over, actors speaking over clips from the film saying, I bet this is going to be silly. They completely, because people laughed at and
John Voight's character in that film, I mean, I don't know what accent he's doing.
Yeah.
But he was fantastically bad in a wonderful way.
It is not a horror performance. No. It is a comic performance.
It is a comic. Now that you talk about it, I remember he does do a lot of that sort of mystical kind of stuff.
And there's lighting that's supposed to make him, there's that one shot of him at the helm of the boat with this red light underneath
him,
and it's supposed to look satanic.
Yes.
And I mean, I saw it with an audience that just could not stop laughing.
Right.
And then, you know, the thing where it's the snake spits him out and he winks at Jennifer Lopez and you're thinking, this was never horror. Someone at some point, I mean, the script probably started as serious and then they drifted, and now we're here.
Did you ever see Hollow Man?
Yes. That is not a pleasant experience.
Right, but that's another one where I remember seeing the trailer for that, and until they said the title, everyone was like, oh, that, you know, there's a few visual effects there and everything, and then they go, Hollow Man. And you're like, Hollow Man? What the hell does Hollow Man mean?
Yeah.
It was so bizarre as a title, and you couldn't take it seriously. I mean, the audience burst out laughing as soon as he said Hollow Man. And actually, up until that point in the trailer, mm-hmm. being like, oh, okay, so the guy's invisible and...
Yeah, you know, Invisible Maniac story, pretty good sell.
Yeah, and it's going to be some good visual effects, and oh, he's seeing a naked woman, and she doesn't know he's there because he's invisible. Right. You know, all the kids had a good... And then suddenly they called it Hollow Man. And they said it in that, you know, that deep sort of sonorous voice.
Trailer
voice,
Hollow Man. Yeah.
And you're like, Hollow Man? Hollow Man?
It just, I mean, you can lose an audience so easily. Mm. But Anaconda never really had the audience. The Room never really had the audience. There's no disappointment. I think maybe that's it. You can't be disappointed by The Room because it either is what you think it's going to be.
Right.
Or it's what you think it's going to be and it's deliriously entertaining.
Right.
And the same with the idea of a film that's so bad it's good. It's real. And again, it's hard to make a movie that is bad on purpose. We see it every now and then where people try to parody a certain type of cinema and it's just that type of cinema in the end, and then you can't break that. But movies like, someone was talking about Deep Blue Sea the other day,
right.
the super smart shark film.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a movie that knows exactly what it wants to do, even if Rennie Harlan doesn't know he's doing it.
Right.
It's fascinating because right. you can watch the film sort of argue with itself throughout.
Right.
And then you come to this place, you come to this weird space where... It is a disastrous success, and it can only entertain and delight because at this point, The Room has come to mean the thing that is this thing. It is its own tautology now.
Yes.
And we're all in Wiseau's world. He's won, and I don't know if he wanted to. And that's what's so fascinating, that we can never fully understand it. And he'll never crack. I mean, if he hasn't talked about it in 13 years as a specific, you know, like, experiential story, if he hasn't given an interview where he talks about his intentions now, it'll never happen.
I mean, it's interesting because he's obviously got an enormous ego.
Mm.
You know, with I've only heard the stories secondhand from my son, but in the book, you know, it talks about how there's a bathroom in the set that they built, and then he had his own bathroom attached to the side of it where he went and nobody else was allowed to go.
Okay.
And there was also, you know, the crew were changed about four different times. He rented the entire studio space for cost a fortune, and then the actors were changed quite often too, and so there was an awful lot of sort of, I am in complete control of this and I'm going to do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it looks to me like all the actors went, okay, and they did exactly what he asked them to do. And I'm wondering whether his ego is ever going to allow him enough to, because at the moment he can walk the tightrope walk of saying, well, you know, you all are here and you're all paying me. And you're all watching the film still. Mm-hmm. And that's what my intention was.
Right.
Well, he doesn't actually have to say...
If you boil it down to my intention was to make a movie people would watch, he's absolutely done it.
And he's done it.
Yeah.
You know, and really successfully.
Yeah.
You know.
It's just that the aesthetic and artistic qualifications are...
Yes.
...open to discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You mentioned the sitcom that he did. I haven't seen that, mm-hmm. but I should.
I don't know that the show actually exists now that I think about it. The trailer is out there on YouTube, floating around to be seen.
Right.
It feels like someone who's trying to steer into the skid.
You know, and the sort of the beauty of The Room is that, again, as we talked about, it's all of those things coming together to create this sort of perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it'd be interesting. I know James Franco is, you know, coming out with...
an adaptation of The Disaster Artist.
Yeah. Yes. And again, it would be tough to capture because it's one thing to you know, it's almost like, actually, it's a bit like the idea of filming sport. Mm. Because the thing about... the thing that makes sport so amazing to watch and entertaining is the fact that it's live, is the fact that anything can happen. And there's a side to the room. Obviously, it's not a sport. It's not live. But that captured something that actually you can't reenact.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, just the thing you were talking about with the angle of the cameras. I mean, you can try and do it, but it's going to feel contrived. It's circumstance, and it's absolutely the circumstance of that film is absolutely the thing that makes it. All of those things that all happened in that time because of that just make it sit in a perfect place. And in its terribleness, because it is, I think, appalling on almost every front, but brilliant. So,
yeah.
You know, and maybe that is the perfect description of what art should be.
Unforgettable in any
conceivable
description.
Exactly.
Yeah, by any means.
Exactly. I've seen the film twice, and I remember great chunks of that film because I just was completely enamored by it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. In its own way.
Yeah. Somebody, I saw a stand-up comic bomb once, but just said, love me or hate me, you'll never forget me.
Right.
He's right. That's right. It. That is what you...
Well, I mean, listen, the argument where you're sitting looking at a diaper and you're outraged by the fact that that's called art, and it's like, well, I got you, didn't I? Because you'll remember, I'm talking to you about this diaper that looked like a used diaper. You know, Tracy Ehrman's teenage bed or whatever she called it. You know?
That's right.
All dirty with condoms and God knows what all, and everybody's like, oh, that's not art, but they're all talking about it and they're all have an emotional reaction to it.
Yeah, may not be art, but it's on the front page and it's on everybody's mind.
There you go.
Which, again, so this brings us to the inevitable final question of the show, which is always the same, which is basically, what if anything of The Room has made it into your creative DNA, or have you borrowed or stolen or referenced, or is it in this case, have you tried desperately to avoid duplicating anything?
Well, I mean, there are things that I can look at in it that I remember so well from low budget filmmaking. You know, there's scenes where you know they had no room, mm-hmm. where you know they didn't have enough lights, where you know that the angles of a setup like that, because they don't have a third wall, where they're all in each other's way, although, you know, when you hear about the budget being $6 million, the fact that they had a studio,
I just assume that it's $6 million, kroner or something. Well, something where if you actually look at it, it won't quite work
right,
out.
Right. I think what I take from it though is a sort of integrity of whatever your ability of, I really do believe that he tried to make the best film that he could. Mm-hmm. And I think that I certainly try and do that. I try and do the best that I can in everything that I do, and I love what I do. So, and I genuinely think he loves what he does. He's just really bad at it.
Yeah.
You know. So I hope I'm not really bad at it, but I certainly I don't know. Watching that film, I feel as though he thought and he tried to do absolutely the best to make the best film that he possibly could. In some ways, he did.
Yes. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it.
My thanks to Jason Connery, whose new film Tommy's Honor opens in Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal this Friday, May 12th. Thanks also to Angie Burns. She knows what she did, and it was a lot more than just reminding us of Lisa's name. Jason's not on Twitter, but you can follow his movie at Tommy's Honor, all one word, honor with a U, and you can find The Room on Blu-ray and DVD from Wizo Films, available at theroommovie.com or a number of online sellers. Or just hang out at your local Midnight Movie Palace. It'll turn up there eventually. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. If not, well, you're tearing me apart. Thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.